I have a live line with us from the Nation and the Capital Times, John Nixel. John Nixel. John Nixel. John Nichols.
Who is that guy?
Who is that guy? Well,
hey, Salil.
I had never really heard about Nigel Farage before.
He's a winner, isn't he?
Let's play a little Nigel.
Threatening people too much actually insults their intelligence. And the lesson from the Obama visit is even more fascinating. And a lot of people in Britain said, how dare the American president come here and tell us what to do? And it backfired. And I think we got an Obama Brexit bounce because people do not want foreign leaders telling them how to think and how to vote.
An Obama Brexit bounce. Actually, he sounds a lot like Stuart Farney from Fox.
He sounds a lot like him. And you realize here he is, a foreign leader on American television, essentially telling Americans what to think.
Well,
so, I mean, is that kind of seeing the kettle, you know, and the pot there? But I've met this guy.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. He's a very big deal in Britain. I mean, he's not a his ideology is a fringe ideology that is now apparently very large. But I met him years ago, back in the 90s, when he was, as he always has been, you know, kind of trying to build an independent, sort of anti-immigrant, UK nationalist party. And back in those days, he was a good deal more subtle about it. He has become this really, he's a huge persona in England. Everybody knows who he is. His UK Independence Party has actually had significant success electorally. It's not a major party, but it's a real presence. And in the campaign on Brexit, on getting out, this is a fascinating thing, because he is so nasty in his way of doing stuff that the actual Leave campaign, the people that wanted to exit, didn't let him be a part of it, right? They sort of pushed him a little bit to the side. And in part, it's because he just has no sense of responsibility. He would say the most outrageous thing imaginable, and then, you know, just say, whoop, never mind. He famously did on the day after the Brexit vote. He's on television, and the interviewer says, okay, so, like, you guys promised that now there's going to be all this money freed up for the National Health Service and all, lots of great stuff is going to happen, and he's like, well, I don't know if that's actually going to happen. There's interviews with him where they're pressing him on it. He literally says, we talked a lot about that during the campaign, but I'm not really so sure.
This thing has such bizarre cross currents on the right-left divide, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Totally. In fact, I've been writing about it a lot. I, as a young writer, spent an immense amount of time in Northern England. Very big advocate for the miners' strike and stand up to Thatcher. And this all roots back to Thatcher. Thatcher destroyed Northern England with an incredibly neglectful set of austerity policies that led to the closure of mines and industries. So lots of Northern England has never really recovered from the Thatcher era. And it is essentially, Sly, it's comparable in some ways to, say, a Youngstown or a Flint or a place like that. Been heavily deindustrialized. People still vote for Labour, by and large, and they actually, you know, still avow many Labour principles. They don't run around saying horrible things, and they're not, you know, a bunch of thugs and stuff like that. But they've been horribly battered economically, and so when this Brexit vote came along, and they were given a chance to vote against the establishment. In these northern industrial towns, it was 60-70% for leaving the European Union. And that's where they lost. They lost in areas that are, which all right, might be comparable to battleground states in the U.S.
Here's what's, and people are drawing parallels with the U.S. There's some, not necessarily entirely, but I did like the piece in The Nation that austerity essentially got the ball rolling on this. But here's what's confusing to me, okay? But Scotland, which has some of the same sentiment that the parts of northern England have, voted to go to stay in, and so did Northern Ireland. And what happens if Northern Ireland breaks free from Great Britain? What happens to the Good Friday Peace Accord? And what happens, you know, what happens with all this stuff?
Maybe they should have thought about that when they were screwing over these places.
Well, okay. I'm not. I don't want you to think that I'm defending the European Union or Great Britain, because I didn't take. I didn't. Honestly, I don't know enough about it to take
a
side.
Bottom line, I know that sounds confusing, right?
Yeah, but I'm trying to have an. I'm trying to understand the cohesiveness of this.
There is a cohesiveness to this. Let's look at Scotland. I spent an immense amount of time there. In Northern England, where they've suffered immense deindustrialization, which is very similar to a lot of the deindustrialization in Scotland. In Northern England, they don't have any way to vote themselves out of the crisis they're in, right? You have now multi-generational poverty, deindustrialization, you know, lack of commitment. I mean, old, great towns and communities really are falling apart, right? And they got no way to vote no, because the way that they've gerrymandered the politics of the country, even though the Tories, the Conservatives, only get, you know, 35 to 45% of the vote, they never get a majority. Government is always Tory, or it has, you know, it's either Tory or, for a long time, it was Blair with sort of a Tory light, and a terrible neglect of the North, right? And they have no way to vote themselves out. Scotland has the prospect of independence, and so for the Scots, they see themselves as separate and future-oriented, even though independence didn't win the referendum. It got over 45% of the vote. And now, according to the polling, independence is polling at close to 55%. And so the Scots have options. They see themselves as being, you know, having some way out. People in Northern England don't, Sly. And this is a big, big deal. It's a way to understand politics that goes beyond personalities and even beyond, you know, sort of easy assessment of issues. If you don't give people options, you know, like some real vision for an alternative to their circumstance, they're going to look for somebody that offers them some option, right? And this is why, this is the lesson.
That sounds like the tale of that sounds like the tale of West Virginia.
Isn't that interesting? You know, I'm just telling you, you know, look, if people believe that they can vote for a positive vision, you know, something good and noble and right that lifts them out of their dire circumstance, they'll do it. But if you don't give them a positive vision, if you don't give them a way to get out of their, you know, poor circumstance, they're going to look for alternatives. That was the genius of Franklin Roosevelt. It's why we still redound back to Franklin Roosevelt. In the midst of the Great Depression, when places across this country were literally devastated and neglected and, you know, really were susceptible to populist appeals from people like Huey Long, even in some cases to, you know, at least an exploration of or sympathy with fascism, along comes Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt says, we're going to electrify our rural communities. We're going to get people's farms back to them, even if they've, you know, defaulted on some loans. We're going to put people to work where there is no work. And you know what? It wasn't a total success, Lie. But it was enough of an alternative vision that America voted for him four times.
Stand by. We'll take a break.
Paul from AMS with us on the Big FM 93.7.
We are having an inventory clearance sale. And we've had some people come in and take excellent advantage of that. And we've got lots and lots of really good equipment left, too.
So your location?
Right near the corner of PD and Verona Road on the southwest side of Madison. You can call us at 608-274-7400, amsmadison.com, or you can even like us on Facebook.
Sounds great. Paul from AMS. While many people were beginning to notice that populism has a lot of power this year, the Democratic Rules Committee, in its initial stages in St. Louis, decided to protect Barack Obama's feelings on the Trans-Pacific platform. Protect his feelings on the platform on the TPP, and voted down a resolution that would have actually put in the party platform our opposition to it. Now, Hillary Clinton is campaigning against it. She doesn't say it very loudly, but that seem a little tone deaf to you, John?
Stunningly so. I had a long conversation today with Keith Ellison, who is the tremendous congressman from up in Minnesota, often an ally of Mark Pocan's, who moved some of the TPP language. And you know, he was sort of shocked because he said, look, I'm not asking you to you know, do something that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders disagree on here. We're asking you to you know, put into the platform what both of the candidates for president, the people who got something like 99% of Democratic votes in primaries and caucuses, favor, which is saying, you know, we're not going to do TPP in the form that it currently exists, and also we're not going to try and sneak it through after the election in a lame bit or anything like that. So he puts forward some, you know, really relatively mild language, and he totally gets shot down by it. Now, here's the big deal. They were literally doing that on the day that everybody, that the stock markets are in tumble, that everything's going chaotic globally after the Brexit vote, right? And instead of saying, wow, we need to really get on top of this stuff to be forward-looking, to recognize that people don't believe that globalization, whatever form it takes, a European Union, a trade deal, whatever, that this sort of promise of some sort of perfect future that comes out of embrace of globalization, that people don't believe that's real. They don't buy that. And so here's where it gets interesting. Their only argument that they made, the only real argument that they made was, well, you know, we don't want to embarrass the president here by taking a stand that is divergent from him on this, on an issue like this. Well, you didn't understand. The guy who was moving the proposal, Keith Ellison, was one of the first members of Congress to endorse Barack Obama for president back in 2007. Nobody campaigned harder for Obama, and nobody has stood by him, you know, on more critical tests. And so this wasn't some anti-Obama thing. It wasn't.
Well, I don't really think it has any. I think Barack Obama is a savvy enough politician in some respects that he really wouldn't care what they do.
I think it has more to do with
Wall Street. On the other hand, did you read the interview with Barack Obama that Bloomberg did?
Yeah.
Okay. Here is Barack Obama.
Now, the last point I'd make on this is the challenge from a perceptions point of view is that the benefits of globalization we take for granted. The costs are highly visible. You can argue that one of the reasons that inflation has been so low over the last two decades is because we're able to get a lot of stuff cheap from all around the world. And you know, we take for granted that we can get a flat screen TV really cheap, or that we get clothes that fit better and last longer than when I was a kid. You know, you walk in the J. Crew or the Gap, and it's a great improvement. I try to tell my kids, you know, you guys look a lot sharper than I did when I was your age, because we went to Sears and there wasn't, you know, it wasn't working the same way.
Is he insulting the garment workers of America that when he was a child? Because that's kind of what that sounded like to me.
I don't know if he's trying to insult anybody, but I think he was missing the point. I was really, really deeply disappointed in that interview and in what was said there. You know, the simple fact of the matter is this. You know, this line about how the benefits are not evident, are not so evident, and the pain is evident. Well, you know why we have politics and government science? It's to figure out how to reduce the pain, increase the benefit, right? There's nobody running around saying, oh, we're never going to trade again.
Yeah, it's the straw man.
Aside from,
yeah.
What people are saying is, we don't have the balance right in our trade deals. We maybe we do keep inflation down on some prices of things. Although, in fact, if you look at it, the actual overall inflation that people deal with is real. And the stagnation of wages is a much more serious issue to my mind. But at some fundamental level, what we want to do, what those of us who are critics of the free trade model that has been in play, really going back in some ways to the Reagan era, is that it always prioritizes Wall Street profits, stocks, you know, things that, you know, paper. It prioritizes paper over the reality of jobs, the environment, communities, democracy itself. We want to up the volume on that human side of it. And there's a real play out in the Brexit vote that's a big deal right now. So Britain votes to leave the European Union. What is the immediate play out? A collapse in the value of the British pound, entry by all the bond rating agencies, you know, lowering, or all these ratings agencies lowering Britain's status, stock market, you know, tanking, and because Britain is such a financial center, that then taking down stock markets in the United States and other places. So this sort of global impact. Why? Not because a factory closed, or not because, you know, something tangible happened. It was a vote, right? But we're now so deeply wrapped up with these financial markets, with this movement of paper over something real, that you know, it's now hard to unwind that.
Right.
We have been locked into
a
circumstance where we are not given much benefit. And so people in a situation like that are going to vote to get out of that circumstance, unless you offer them a smarter way to go forward.
Let me play you one more thing. This is Jared Bernstein, who, of course, at one time was what? The chief of staff for Biden?
He was a very high-ranking advisor.
Yeah, okay. Here we are.
Bernie Sanders there is making a very germane point, and it's one that's been very live in our own election campaign, not just from him, but actually from him, Donald Trump, and from Hillary Clinton. You know, for years, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, your answer to globalization, to communities that have been hurt by it, to workers that have been hurt by it, and not just hurt by it yesterday, but hurt by it for many years running, has always been more globalization.
Right.
Here's yet another trade pact, and yes, the last one didn't work well, but this one's going to be great for you. And if you don't believe that, then you just don't understand global macroeconomics. Well, I think that the one of the positive attributes in at least our campaign, I think Leave is more complicated in the Brexit, but in our own campaign, is that falsehood has really been elevated. The problem is, where do you go with it? Do you blame immigration? Do you blame the others? Do you blame the European Union? You know, if you're Donald Trump, do you blame the Muslims and the Mexicans? And in fact, you know, I think what Bernie's been trying to do, and Hillary as well, has been to suggest that globalization is here to stay. We're not putting that toothpaste back in the tube, but it has to be managed. The EU very much bungled the management of globalization, of immigration, of fiscal policy, and we see the result. We can't do that anymore here.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear her talk about it once in a while with a little passion.
I'd like to say that that's not enough also. Look, I really respect a lot of what's being said there. There's a lot of truth in that.
Uh-huh.
But there's a deeper, more fundamental truth. Globalization, as it has been advanced, is anti-democratic. It takes the power to make fundamental decisions away from voters, from citizens, even from their elected representatives, and it hands it off to unelected bureaucrats in distant places. And this is where our trade deals begin to parallel the problems with the European Union. The criticism of the European Union was that, you know, it was imposing all sorts of structures, many of them good, many things I happen to agree with, but without any kind of, you know, real fundamental democratic control from those who are affected. Similarly, when you go into a NAFTA agreement, permanent normalization of trade relations with China via the WTO, when you talk about this TPP, other initiatives of this sort, it's always behind closed doors, negotiated in secret, put on a fast track, And then, when and if it's approved, power handed off to extrajudicial panels, secretive panels that make decisions about, you know, whether the people in the United States can require labeling of products and of food for country of origin, whether the people in the United States can set standards for emission, you know, all sorts of things that are fundamental to a democratic society shaping itself. Effectively, globalization has too frequently, even though it's very, very good in a lot of ways, it has too frequently become an avenue by which corporations organize the economy to their benefit with very limited checks and balances. And in that situation, Slide, eventually people are going to feel so powerless and so angry that they're going to strike out in ways that they don't even necessarily want to. And they may come to regret it, as many Brits are. But the end result is, it's austerity and it's anti-democracy that creates the mess.
Amen to that. By the way, I got to wrap it up, but my favorite part of the Obama interview with Bloomberg is when he lectured politicians about going to factory towns and promising things they wouldn't deliver. And
well, my.
Yeah. I remember 2008. Do you?
I remember it very well. In fact, I think some of the most important pieces that I wrote during the 2008 campaign were out of Janesville. Initially out of Janesville, then Barack Obama did what Russ Feingold had suggested. Go to Janesville, talk about trade. Obama did it. Quite remarkable. Gave a pretty good speech. And then, tragically, in my view, after he secured the nomination, he gave an interview to, I believe it was Fortune magazine, in which he said, well, you know, you say things on the campaign trail.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Have a great day.
Take care, brother.
All right.
Sly's Office.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.